Hi, and welcome to the Rachel Sellers Podcast, a podcast dedicated to providing free education about all things mental health. This podcast is about ending the mental health stigma and helping people cultivate a deeper awareness and understanding of themselves. Mental health education matters, and I'm here to share with you what I've learned and what I know. I'm your host, Rachel, and I'm so glad you're here. I'm so glad you're back for the Polyvagal Part 2 podcast. So if you haven't listened to the previous episode, I want you to do that before listening to this one. It's going to be pretty hard to understand the content here if you don't have the primer of last week's episode. So pause here, go listen to the one, Polyvagal Part 1, and then come back and listen to this one. I promise you that it will make more sense and you'll just get more out of listening to it. So last week I talked about the polyvagal theory, talking about how our nervous system functions primarily as a means of detecting danger and keeping us safe. So today I want to talk a little bit about why I think that's important. You know, why am I kicking off my podcast with that topic? Why am I like such a nerd about this theory? Why do I think you need to know about it? So I have kind of four reasons that we're going to go through today as to some of the implications for understanding some of this science. So the first one that I think is super important is that what we now know from knowing about the polyvagal theory and really just other recent neuroscience findings related to the impact of trauma. There's been some really cool research that's come out in the past decade. This is giving therapists, it's giving helpers a new way of understanding mental health. At least it needs to be. So what we're realizing and what we're learning is that experiencing good mental health is not just about healing the brain. It's not just about replacing negative thoughts with positive ones or even neutral ones. That's important, but good mental health is so much more about healing the whole self and healing the whole body. For me and my approach to working with clients, my approach to mental health, no matter what the presenting disorder is, my assumption and my understanding is that you have trauma. Every single client I see, every single person walking on this planet has trauma. Okay, so if that's true, then improving your mental health in every facet, in every way, also means achieving balance within the different parts of the nervous system, teaching them how to work together, teaching clients how to be in tune with their bodies and what, you know, listening to that wisdom. This theory has kind of shifted on, you know, the understanding of mental health too, and the way that, it really is just bringing light. Like, we're not brains on sticks. Because of our vagus nerve, there's so much about mental health that is also connected to physical health. One of my favorite therapists and teachers, her name is Dr. Karen Purvis, and she has this quote that says, "Holistic harm needs holistic healing." When we experience hard things, divorce, abuse, losing a loved one, getting a hard diagnosis, or something as simple as just having a conflict with a friend, it's the whole body that is harmed. It's the whole body that responds and reacts. So as we talk about various mental health topics on this podcast, I'm going to talk about them through a polyvagal lens, which is why I am starting my podcast with this season. There's a rhyme and reason to that. That's why I wanted to do this kind of primer, because as we dive into more talking about different mental health topics, I'm going to use this language, and that is, you know, it's a little bit of insight as to why we're starting here. So I want to talk to you, just to give you a couple examples. We'll dive much deeper with this in other episodes of the podcast, but I want to give you a couple of examples about what I mean when I say I'm going to talk about this, you know, through a polyvagal lens. So what I mean by that is that when I'm talking about anxiety, to me, anxiety is not just a cognitive or an emotional state. Anxiety has a physiological component. It is a physiological state, a result of an overactive sympathetic nervous system. Underneath anxiety is fear. And fear has a mental, a physical, and an emotional component. Fear, chronic stress, anxiety fundamentally change the body's nervous system. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. When we're looking and talking about depression, again, depression is not just an emotional or a cognitive state. It's a physiological state. It's a result of an overactive dorsal vagal system. Feelings of hopelessness, helplessness, and isolation are associated with the body being in a state of conservation. That happens because of the survival response, because of the dorsal vagal system. That's why when we're working with clients who are struggling with depression, we're going to see more of that flat affect, not a lot of facial expression, and more dissociation. That is related to the nervous system response and the way that the brain and the body are communicating with each other. When we look at something like ADHD, we're looking at a chronically overactive sympathetic nervous system, a body that is on kind of a cortisol overload and needs social engagement and needs regulation as a part of treatment. People who struggle with OCD, they struggle with having intrusive thoughts. And these are unwanted, distressing thoughts. Those thoughts activate their stress response systems and cause more sympathetic activation. That's why that people that are struggling with OCD, that's why they have compulsions, is a way to deactivate or get rid of that embodied anxiety that these intrusive thoughts are causing. What we know is that trauma fundamentally disrupts the nervous system. It knocks it off balance. And we have brain scans to prove that. And if that's true, it means that trauma recovery is also more than just symptom reduction. It means that recovery is a fundamental recalibration of the nervous system so that the body learns to trust that it's safe in the here and now, and that the danger that the body is neurocepting and experiencing in the present actually belongs to the past. We'll talk so much more about that. I'm going to do a whole season on trauma and really unpack that in a pretty detailed way. Eating disorders is something I'm super passionate about. I'm going to do a season about that too. That's season two of this podcast. Eating disorder behaviors are manifestations of this fight or flight or freeze energy. So behaviors that we see in people struggling with an eating disorder, like restriction, binging, or purging, their attempts to feel regulated or safe. I'm going to explain more about, you know, I'm going to really dive into that into our second season, but I give you those examples for a reason, because I want you to know that that is how I'm going to be, in some senses, talking about mental health on this podcast. I'm always going to loop in and bring in this more embodied approach, and we're going to talk about different disorders and how that changes, not how that changes, that's not the right word, but how, you know, what's the physiology going on? How does it change the body when someone is struggling with that specific mental disorder? So that's the first reason why I think this is important. The second reason, and this leads into this point, remember in that last episode, I explained this word neuroception. And I explained that it's a thing that our bodies do outside of conscious awareness, so we don't know this is happening, but it's how our body is constantly scanning the environment to determine whether situations or people are safe or dangerous. It's that detection without awareness. When we experience trauma, which every single one of us have to different degrees, and all of it have, you know, we all have it stored in our bodies to different degrees. But when someone has repeated doses of trauma over the course of their life, they develop something that Stephen Porges talks about and calls faulty neuroception. So faulty neuroception happens when the body detects a threat. So when the body activates a survival response when there's actually no threat at all. In other words, a person reacts to a safe situation as if it was threatening, or the opposite can happen. A person reacts to a truly threatening situation as if it were safe. The part of the brain that's involved in this response is called the amygdala. And this is this tiny little almond-shaped structure in the part of your brain that is called the limbic system. So that part of the brain is responsible for emotional and behavioral responses. Okay, so this tiny little almond thing has for its size, it's got a pretty big job. It is associated with the body's fear and stress response. I do a lot of psychoeducation with parents because I work with adolescents. And I explain this often as the amygdala alarm. So just like an alarm in a house goes off when something, it detects danger on the outside, it's the exact same thing with the body. The amygdala alarm, when it goes off because the body perceives a threat, it releases cortisol and other stress hormones in the body, and it's mobilizing the body to respond to a dangerous situation. That's amazing. It's amazing that we were born with this amazing thing called an amygdala that keeps us safe. It's adaptive. It works in favor of our survival when we need to be self-protected. It's not necessarily helpful if my amygdala alarm is firing and misfiring multiple times a day, alerting my body to danger when the danger has passed, when there's not actually danger in the present moment, but when the body is responding to a past event or just neurocept something as being dangerous when it's not actually dangerous. I think to some degree we are, we've all experienced this because we're all traumatized because of COVID-19. A global pandemic is trauma. And in many ways, I think we all kind of have this overactive amygdala a little bit with going in public, going to the grocery store, running errands. We're afraid that we might get this virus. And I think that I say that to say that this idea of faulty neuroception really does fall on a spectrum. I think we do all have it to some degree. I'm going to give you an example or two about what this might look like just to kind of help it become a little bit more concrete. So this shows up a lot in relationships. So, and how we act and how we communicate in relationships. So let's say someone has a history of sexual abuse or has a lot of struggles with their body image or just associates physical touch with a past trauma or with just a general feeling of unease. So let's say you are now with the man or woman of your dreams. You feel so safe with them and you go to have sex or be intimate in any way and your body freezes up and just freaks out and panics. Consciously, you know your partner is safe. You might honestly be confused or frustrated about why your body is reacting this way. But your body has still initiated a self-protective response because it's learned based on past experience that physical touch or sex equals dangerous. Another example would be communicating with a friend or a partner. Let's say you grew up in a home where conflict was really scary. Or involved a lot of yelling or violence. Maybe you never had the opportunity to share your perspective or your opinion within your family dynamic and your voice was silenced. So fast forward to now, and you get in an argument with a friend or a spouse. If the verbal and especially the nonverbal facial cues are huge here, if those verbal or nonverbal cues even remotely resemble something from the past, your body might respond and initiate a survival or a self-protective response. You might get defensive really quickly or just totally shut down and dissociate completely in the face of conflict, even a small conflict that's not really a big deal. Consciously, you know your partner's safe, but your body hasn't learned it yet. This is because our bodies respond before our thinking brain really can assess a situation logically or rationally. A more classic example of this would be something like going on a hike and seeing something that looks like a snake, but is actually a stick. This has actually happened to me before. If my body perceives that stick to be a snake, whether it's a snake or not, it's going to activate my sympathetic nervous system. And you're probably going to like freak out and then laugh about it when you realize that it's a stick. And the laughter there in a moment like that is actually a way of getting you back towards a state of regulation. Another example would be a soldier who just came back from combat and is in a parking lot and hears a car door slam really loud and immediately drops to the ground. His amygdala alarm was activated because his body neurocepted that loud noise in the very same way that it did a bullet. The bodily response is the same, and the body responds first. Experiences of faulty neuroception are sometimes called triggers. We don't, you know, that language is much more common now to say, oh, something triggered me. We don't say, oh, my body faultily neurocepted something. No, we just say something triggered me. A trigger is when something in the present activates a survival or a self-protective response based on your past experiences. You know that this has happened to you if you've ever found yourself saying something like, why the heck did I just react like that? That has happened to me more times than I would like to admit with my partner. But it happens, right? And there's always a reason for the way that we react in the way that we do. There's always a reason. It's just usually unconscious until it's made conscious. Dr. Porges believes that this is the root of many mental health problems. He writes about this and talks about it extensively, and I really agree with him. In an article he wrote, he talks about how areas in the brain that are assumed to inhibit the fight, flight, or freeze reactions, what we know based on brain scans and stuff, they're not activated in people with autism or schizophrenia, who have difficulty with social engagement. He talks about how individuals with anxiety disorders and depression often have compromised social behavior. And we see that. We see difficulties in regulating the heart rate. We see reduced facial expressiveness and affect in clients that are struggling with depression and even anxiety. Where we see this show up in a really, I think, obvious way is when we're working with maltreated and abused kids that have been diagnosed with reactive attachment disorder. In those children, and I have experience working with kids that have these behaviors and have these tendencies, they tend to either be inhibited, meaning that they're really withdrawn or unresponsive, or they're uninhibited, meaning that they get close to people really, really fast. You know, within 5 seconds of meeting someone, they're your new best friend in terms of attachment. Both types of these behaviors suggest faulty neuroception in the environment. So reason number three, that I feel like this is important, that I feel like why I feel like this has implications. Healthy relationships heal. Like literally they heal. Some of the founders of humanistic psychology, Carl Rogers for one, he knew this, right? Like his whole premise of psychology is like the relationship heals. I needed to take a sip of water because I had a tickle in my throat. We see this in babies. Babies literally rely on human connection for their growth and survival. Like there is in babies that do not get physical touch, they do not get their attachment needs made. We see stunted growth. We see, this is harsh, but like we see this in orphanages, like babies die if they are not in connection with humans. So what we know about relationships is that relationships heal people. I've talked, you know, a lot about these fight, flight, or freeze states and how these are activated in almost every mental health disorder or disease that we see. Depression, anxiety, eating disorders, trauma, OCD, and insert whatever other struggle. What they have in common is one thing, and it is dysregulation of the nervous system. I'm going to say that again. Every single mental health disorder has this one thing in common, and that is an unregulated nervous system. an overactive or an underactive amygdala alarm, which this in turn impacts our thoughts, our emotions, our beliefs, and our behaviors. And this isn't our fault. This is the body doing exactly what it was designed to do. Like, we were created for self-preservation. So way to go, body. Like, thank you for the way that you've kept me alive and have helped me to survive hard things. The problem with that, though, is that we're all, as so many of us, and I did it for years, we're all just walking around this earth largely unconsciously with so much grief and pain and heavy self-protective armor based on the things that we've stuffed that we have not wanted to look at. And that's problematic, and it's causing disease. We were never meant to stay in these defensive states. We were not meant to live our lives oscillating between this fight or flight energy or just dissociated collapse. And yet so many of us are living our lives this way due to unresolved trauma and hurt that we've buried or stuffed. Things that we've just said are not that bad, or not that painful. It's no big deal. That's cool, except for not really, because our bodies remember these experiences that we just want to kind of slough off and ignore. And our bodies are responding to them, whether we're aware of it or not. You know, I know this from the research. I've also lived this in my lived experience as someone who is fully recovered from an eating disorder. I know what it feels like to live in this sympathetic fight or flight, like domination. That is so much of our culture anyways, this hustle and grind culture that is overactive fight or flight on all the time. And it's completely exhausting. And we cannot be healthy mentally or physically when this is our pattern. I believe that we were created to be in close relationships with ourselves. That's the most important relationship you're ever going to have. You know, your relationship with you is your longest standing relationship. The way you talk to yourself matters. The way you regard yourself matters. And we are also created to be in close relationships with other people. Hyper-independence, this like, I don't need anyone, guilty for most of my life, is a trauma response. And it's, you know, Lord, have I learned that one the hard way. But we are created to be in close relationships. What the polyvagal theory says is that the neuroception of safety, feeling safe in my body, in my environment, is a prerequisite for that. A neuroception of safety is necessary before I can engage socially, before social engagement behaviors can occur. So like, that's why if my body doesn't sense safety around you, like I'm gonna be protective. And that's not my conscious brain doing that. Like that's my body's nervous system. That's why if I feel uneasy, like I might not really wanna talk to you or like smile at you. And that's not a conscious choice that I'm making. That is my nervous system responding to not feeling necessarily super safe, right? We have to be able to activate that social engagement system, that ventral vagal state, in order to feel grounded, to feel connected in relationships, and to feel present in our lives and in our relationships. There's this hormone, a neurochemical, it's called oxytocin. And it's involved in the formation of social bonds. So essentially, this makes social behaviors possible by blocking defensive freezing behavior. So when there's an increase in oxytocin, this is sometimes called the love hormone or the bonding hormone, it makes it possible for me to be connected in relationships. This hormone is released during physical touch, like a hug, sex, during childbirth, even during lactation. And oxytocin release helps to build trust in relationships, helps to foster secure attachment. It helps us with relaxation too. One of my old mentors and supervisors, her name is Paris Goodyear Brown. She's phenomenal, amazing play therapist. And one of the metaphors that she kind of talks about is when we're working with specifically in this context that she's talking about it, we're working with traumatized kids. But I think it applies to literally every single one of us. She talks about this neurochemical boxing match. So if you imagine two people in a boxing ring, one of them is oxytocin, and then the other one is cortisol, which is that stress hormone, right? And it's kind of like this neurochemical boxing match is happening in our brains all the time. And cortisol, the stress hormone, and oxytocin are kind of like fighting for space in our brains and in our lives. And what we need to help fight the stress response and to help fight these cascades of cortisol that happen when we are experiencing trauma, when we're stressed, we need oxytocin. That's why like pets, dogs, cats, whatever, like are so soothing to us. That's where this whole idea of an emotional support animal came from. Like that when a child or when you are engaging with, I'm going to say golden retriever because I'm biased. I love them. But let's say you're snuggled up with a golden retriever. That is, you're releasing oxytocin in the brain, and that is helping to combat stress. And oxytocin release also kind of helps ground us back into our bodies, back into the present moment. When someone has experienced a lot of trauma or is struggling with a mental disorder, social connection can also feel really unsafe, okay? Our greatest wounds happen in relationship, and the paradox is that our greatest doses of healing also often happen in relationship. But for someone who has been repeatedly harmed in relationship with others, any type of abuse, let's say, social relationships can feel like a huge risk because they are a huge risk. And I think we need to honor that. We need to understand that. I think just as people, as humans living in society, that sometimes relationships can be hard because we've been hurt in them, and our bodies have learned to keep us safe by shutting the door, making it hard to connect with people. But what we know, and dang, we've seen this with COVID, like social connection is imperative to our health, to our mental health, to our physical health. And I think that the polyvagal theory gives us real science to show like, yeah, relationships heal. Boom, we got the proof. We know the mechanisms as to how this works now, which is kind of cool. The last thing I'm going to say, kind of the fourth and final reason that I think this is important, is because awareness is important. Part of my heart for this podcast is helping you understand why you do what you do. And you cannot understand this without a basic understanding of your own body. You can't change what you don't have an awareness of. So by the end of this season, what I hope for you, and we're going to talk more about that, I'm going to give you like how to do this. I want you to be able to recognize which state your body is in and get curious about it. Are you grounded? Are you in that ventral state, or are you in a sympathetic activation or a dorsal shutdown? I want you to get curious about that. And in our next episode, I'm going to dive into something called the polyvagal ladder, which is going to help you give you a tool, a visual that can kind of help you better understand and get in touch with your nervous system, and just kind of start to have a better sense of awareness of some of these things. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope that you learned something new, and I'll see you for the next episode on the polyvagal ladder. Have a good one. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you learned something new. Just a reminder that this podcast is about mental health and mental health concepts, and education about psychology and therapy is not a substitute for individual therapy. If you want to help this podcast grow and get it into the hands of other listeners, please subscribe, rate, or leave me a review. It really does make a difference.